Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, author, professor, and retired New York Supreme Court judge Diane Kiesel talks about her latest book, When Charlie Met Joan, The Tragedy of the Chaplain Trials and the Failings of American Law. This examination of famed actor and comedian Charlie Chaplin will be published this February by the University of Michigan Press. Diane Kiesel was interviewed by fellow biographer and bio member Debbie Applegate.
Hi, this is Debbie Applegate, and I am here today to have the great privilege of interviewing Diane Kiesel. May I say Judge Diane Kiesel, if that's still appropriate, former judge and eminent biographer and attorney who has a fabulous new book coming out in February on Charlie Chaplin. I usually don't spend a lot of time on introductions because we don't have a lot of time. And of course, we have the whole internet at our fingertips. But I would say about this about Diane, so impressive, so charming. She began her life as a journalist in Washington, D.C., covering the Congress and Supreme Court, but then decided, like so many wise journalists do, to go back to law school. I believe you have even MFA. Am I right about that, Diane?
I have a master's in journalism, but I did that before I went to law school.
There you go. So she's educated and canny. I've worked for many years, securities, First Amendment cases at a Wall Street law firm. Very impressive. Worked for the legendary Robert Morgenthau in the prosecutor's office in New York County. Specialized in sex crimes, corruption, and child abuse, all the things that make for good biographies, if you ask me. And meanwhile, during all that time, also managed to write 3 books. When I first met you, I believe you had just finished She Can Bring Us Home, Dr. Dorothy Boulding Farabee, a civil rights pioneer. Her new book, When Charlie Met Joan, The Tragedy of the Chaplin Trials and the Failings of American Law, is coming out from the University of Michigan. So we're going to talk about Charlie Chaplin and his great and fascinating scandals. Thank you for being here, Diane. So I would like to start just by talking a little bit about who Charlie Chaplin was. This seems like a question that should not have to be asked, but I have been telling everyone about your book since I read it, and I know there are some younger folk out there who don't realize just what a titan of international culture he really was. So could you say a little bit about why we should care about him now?
Well, it is a little surprising to me that there is a generation who doesn't know who Charlie Chaplin is. Think of him as Taylor Swift on steroids, okay?
Well, without the sound.
Right, without the sound. Good point. Charlie Chaplin was the most famous man in America in his day, and perhaps the most famous man in the world. His day coincides with the birth of cinema. He was born in 1889 to a pair of English vaudevillians. He was born in London. They had a very middle-class life until his father drank himself to death at age 37, and his mother went insane, either due to a family history of mental illness or, some authors say, untreated syphilis. Be that as it may, this altered Chaplin's life forever, because as his mother cycled through insane asylums, he and his older half-brother cycled in and out of workhouses and orphanage schools. They finally launched their own careers as teenage boys when they joined a British comedy troupe. And in 1910, Chaplin came to America with that comedy troupe. He was seen on the New York stage by Max Sennett, who was a movie producer of the famous Keystone Cops, were Max Sennett's invention. Charlie was hired for $125 a week in 1914. And within a year, he had left Keystone Studios and essentially had a $1 million contract, and within 4 years had his own studio and was the king of motion pictures. He made 82 movies in his lifetime. He wrote most of them, acted in most of them, directed in most of them. And some of them are classics to any film student. The Gold Rush, The Kid.
The Kid, I think, has got to be one of the best movies I've ever seen.
I would agree.
I mean, it's got everything. What is it that pulled American audiences so much to him? What was it that we all loved so much and still love, those of us who know him?
Because he understood the power of cinema. Rather than do a Max Sennett kind of Keystone Cop throwing pies and car chases, he recognized just what you recognized in The Kid, that movies could be both humorous, poignant, real. And because his character, which, by the way, I didn't talk about, he developed this character called the Little Tramp, who came from nowhere, seemed to be going nowhere. He wore an oversized pair of pants, an undersized jacket, a little derby, a little teeny mustache. He was, who was he? Nobody knows, but he managed to get himself in and out of situations that were both hilarious, frightening, moving, and everyone could identify with him. There have been more than 100 biographies of Chaplin. This is a look at how, just like his character, the Little Tramp, used to get in and out of trouble, so too the real Charlie Chaplin managed to get himself in and out of trouble constantly with women, with the government, with his partners in the film industry. He was an original founding partner of United Artists. He was always fighting with his own, with Mary Pickford, one of his other partners. He was an interesting figure.
So he is at the top of his career and it begins to crack. Some of it is he, as you yourself say, he has a knack for getting himself into trouble, but some of his trouble was worse than others. Can you tell me what you are focusing on here in this book? As you point out, there are so many general biographies. This is really a focused book.
This is a focused book on Charlie Chaplin's life from 1941 through his exile from this country in 1942. Charlie Chaplin once bragged that he had slept with 2,000 women in his lifetime. And by the way, he was short. He was anywhere between 5'4" and 5'6", but ladies loved him. He was handsome underneath that clown makeup. He had a way with women. And this is not about the 2,000 women. This is about one. My view is if he had stopped at 1999, we wouldn't be sitting here talking, okay? The one is a woman named Joan Barry. And they're meeting, they're hooking up, their very brief but explosive relationship ended up really destroying both of their lives. Charlie also liked women who were much younger than he was. He had three, if not four wives. I say three, if not four, because we're not sure whether he was ever really married to Paulette Goddard. They lived together for 10 years, but they were always very coy about whether they were actually married. My view is they probably weren't. Be that as it may, he married two of the four because one was pregnant at 15 and he thought he was going to go to jail. The other one he thought was pregnant at about 17 or 18 turned out to be a false alarm. Una was 17 when they began their relationship. They married at 18. Joan shows up between Paulette Goddard and Una. Charlie is at a period of his life where terrible things are happening. First of all, movies have gone from silent to talkies. Therefore, his little tramp character cannot work anymore in these movies because the little tramp, to be universal, cannot speak. He has to be every man, right? So he's at a loss over what to do with his movies. Paulette Goddard, who arguably was one of his more successful relationships, that sort of falls apart for a reason nobody quite knows.
If I might ask, it seems to me that Paulette Goddard, is that how you, is it preferred as Goddard? That she is the one also with the most sense of self and the most ambition. So they have something that's a little bit closer to a relationship of equals.
Exactly. And it's an excellent point. I say in the book that she was a lot like Chaplin without his severe depression, because Chaplin, like his mother, had some issues. I'm loath to analyze somebody without a degree and, from 100 years in the past. But there are some authors and some of his friends, even like Sam Goldwyn, talked about how he would have these very, very black depressions after a period of extraordinary productivity. So he's got some of his own issues. So he's in one of his down moods. Who does he bump into on a blind date? The idea that Charlie Chaplin has to go out on a blind date, right? On a blind date, this woman named Joan Barry. Now, her real name was Mary Louise Berry. She came from Brooklyn. She reminded one of Chaplin's friends of a Brooklyn stenographer, but she was gorgeous. She had flaming red hair, and she herself had some serious psychological problems.
The
Two of
pictures of her, may I say, in your book are quite lovely and interesting. She's not a classic movie star looker. She's fresh-faced and girl next door, which might have even added to some of the problems, I would guess.
Well, and it's that fresh-faced girl next door that caused Chaplin to spend $20,000 to buy a script for her called Shadow and Substance, in which she was going to play an Irish maid, scrub face, who had visions of Saint Bridget in her head. Be that as it may, she had her own psychological issues. Her father had killed himself when she was a child. Her paternal grandmother killed herself by blowing out the gas lamp and breathing it in. And she, after her relationship with Chaplin, ended up in a mental hospital for 10 years. So these two are sort of a perfect storm. Be that as it may, they meet in 1941. He immediately is taken with her. He signs her to a 6-month contract at his studio and buys her this script. He sends her to get her teeth straightened, get a new wardrobe, sends her for dramatic lessons, and all is well for about 3 months until she gets pregnant by Chaplin. She is pressured by Chaplin to have an abortion, which she does. They continue their relationship. She gets pregnant a second time and has a second abortion. And now her interest in being a star has started to wane, primarily because she's not willing to do the kind of hard work that Chaplin expects one of his leading ladies to do. Every leading lady in every one of his movies pretty much ended up sleeping with him, and they all talk about how focused he was, how he expected so much out of them, and she was not willing to do that. So
Or
she
perhaps not capable of doing it also, if she
that
was as
may be.
unstable as she seemed.
Exactly. So she then decides she wants to go home to mother in New York. Chaplin, who is somewhat ticked off because he has spent a lot of money on her. And by the way, his reputation, as one friend said, he was tighter than the bark on a tree, which I find a wonderful description. But nonetheless, she has now become more trouble than she's worth. So he's happy to give her a couple $100, buy her a train ticket, and send her back to New York. However, Joan has become something of a stalker. So while she wants to go back to New York, a part of her wants Chaplin to prevent her from going so that she can be in his life in some meaningful way. I think what she really wanted was to be Mrs. Chaplin and be taken care of by him, which he was not going to do at this point in his life.
Why does it all blow up? Because this surely is not his first time dealing with a gold digging young woman, and it's not even her first time dealing with a powerful older man who's clearly, well, maybe it's not clear, but it seems to me using her for sex, because she's got a fascinating history for such a young woman.
She's got a great resume with rich and powerful older men. When she first gets to Hollywood, she, through a struggling B movie actress, meets J. Paul Getty, spends a considerable amount of time with him in Mexico. He basically supports her for months until she meets Chaplin. He buys her a car. He pays her bills. She spends a lot of time living in fancy hotels in California. Getty takes care of them. She has a relationship with an international race car driver named Hans Rusch. handsome from a wealthy family. She has a relationship with David Hecht, who happens to be Getty's young, handsome, very successful lawyer. And the list just goes on and on. Remember, this is a woman whose father blew his brains out when she was six. And I think she's looking throughout her life for someone to take care of her, to keep her safe.
It is not easy for a woman who is not married to support herself.
In wartime Hollywood, you're absolutely right. These girls, and I hesitate to use the word girl around grown women, but that's what they were called back then. These girls would come to Hollywood by the busloads. They'd get these 6 month, $75 a week contracts with options to renew. And most of them after 6 months ended up either going back home to mother or ended up being arm candy for some Hollywood producer. They were treated like fungible goods. And, you know, in fairness, the sexism of Hollywood did not begin with the Me Too movement. It began from the day motion pictures were invented. So the perfect storm is Charlie's politics started to move further and further to the left. He was calling for the opening of a second front during World War II in Europe to assist Russia. He became very close to Russian expats. The FBI had opened a file on him as early as 1922, believing that he, if not being an outright communist, had communist sympathies and tendencies. They never had any proof he was a communist. He liked to hang around with left-leaning intellectuals. He liked to pontificate. And by the way, I think his formal education stopped when he was 11. This is not a man who was a great thinker, although he was a great reader, and he liked to surround himself with intellectuals on the left.
So nothing more dangerous than a millionaire commie, I guess, is really.
I guess, at least to J. Edgar Hoover,
that guy's a capitalist if I ever saw one as well.
Well, I have to tell you, later on when the government was trying to deport him as a communist, they sent an investigator from what used to be called INS, the Immigration Naturalization Service, and they're asking him a million questions about his communist proclivities. Finally, he says, look, I'm worth $30 million. What are we talking about communism for? Which is like a great answer, right?
But not enough for J. Edgar Hoover.
Exactly. So the FBI is already looking at him, okay? Joan goes to New York on his dime. She finds out that he's going to New York to make another one of his second front speeches at Madison Square Garden. And she starts calling him and calling him and calling him. She wants to see him. So basically, to shut her up and get rid of her, he gives her two tickets to go see the speech. And afterward, she bumps into him. He ends up meeting her for dinner with other friends. She ends up somehow back in his hotel at the Waldorf. Whether or not they had sex that night, who knows? She cries that she's broke. He gives her another couple of $100. And instead of using that to pay her bills, she uses it to come back to California, whereby she continues to stalk him and call him, show up at his home intoxicated. She breaks in repeatedly. He's sort of at his wit's end with her until he finally tells her to get lost. And 2 weeks after that, she shows up at his home with a gun, threatening to kill him. This ends up being crucial because it's in the middle of December, shortly before Christmas. And she claims on that night when she threatened him with a gun, they had sex and she got pregnant. She leaves after the gun incident and she ends up faking her own suicide on New Year's Eve. She ends up getting arrested and essentially told by the Beverly Hills law enforcement, get out of town. The feeling is Charlie's behind that because he lived in Beverly Hills.
Wasn't uncommon. The LA police were renowned for protecting the Hollywood bigwigs. And the idea that you could be sent out of town and told, don't come back, and that's your punishment, was fairly common at that time.
Exactly right. So she leaves. She moves on to go back stalking Getty. She spends some time chasing after David Hecht. But the long and short of it is, she then returns in May pregnant and claims it's Charlie's baby. Now, the problem here is By then, he's already seeing 17-year-old Una O'Neill, which he has to keep quiet because she's not 18 yet and he's in his mid-50s. She essentially comes to Charlie's house and says, you got to marry me. You got to make me an honest woman. And he's like, that's not happening. And she has nowhere left to turn. So what does she do? She turns to Hedda Hopper.
You might want to say a word about Hedda Hopper for those who don't
remember.
Hedda
Hopper is a very famous columnist, as famous as Charlie in her day. Back in the days when newspapers were king, she was in just about every one of them in America. And she hates Charlie Chaplin because her politics are as far to the right as his are to the left. And her husband, famous for reciting Casey at the Bat on stage, is a big philanderer. So she hates philanderers. Hello, Charlie. She hates left-leaning people. Hello, Charlie. And she's only too happy now to set the ball in motion to try and write a column, get other reporters to pick up on this story, and basically to finally hold Charlie accountable for his politics and his ways with women.
Now, literally, we could talk about this for hours. This is
right.
A fabulous book that really made me very tense, actually, as I was reading it, because I kept thinking, everything you're doing, wait, this is only going to get worse and worse and worse. And of course, it does get worse. It explodes into a huge trial, right?
Yes. Ultimately, Charlie gets arrested for violating the Mann Act, which is bringing a woman across state lines for immoral purposes. He gets tried in federal court in Los Angeles. Unfortunately, the prosecutor is new. He wants to make a name for himself. Charlie ends up hiring the most important criminal defense lawyer in California of his day, a guy named Jerry Giesler, who charges Charlie a fortune but manages to get him off. The other problem, though, is there's this baby now that Joan Barry has given birth to, who she still claims is Chaplin's. They cut a deal where he'll pay her a certain amount of money, but 4 months after the baby's born, they will do paternity testing. If it's not his kid, they'll both walk away. Turns out they do paternity testing. It's not his child, but she doesn't walk away. Now there's a series of state court paternity trials, which end up, unfortunately, finding for Joan and the baby, even though pre-DNA blood testing prove this kid is not Charlie Chaplin's. It becomes known as a miscarriage of justice and essentially contributes to Charlie paying child support for 21 years for a kid it's not his, and a complete change in paternity laws around the country. Ultimately, a decade later, when America really turns to the right, and Charlie, who is not a citizen, wants to travel to London to promote his latest movie, he seeks to get a reentry permit, as all aliens must do when they leave the country. And that's when the government really decides to use these trials, his womanizing, and his politics against him. And once he goes to London, the door's shut and he's never allowed back in the country again.
Well, this is fascinating. We could keep talking about this forever, as far as I am concerned. But let's just turn to the question of craft here. Can you tell us about this path that you took here from being a reporter, which is a very different kind of writing, to doing a fair amount of legal writing, I mean, a lot of legal writing, to then switching into something that is very much in the historian's bailiwick? Can you say a few words about how you managed that?
Well, this story is essentially a law story. Although we've talked about kind of the background, this is a story about a series of trials. And my entire professional experience for the last 35 years has been either participating in trials or presiding over them. So I know how they work. I know their background. So that, coupled with my own experience as a reporter who covered the Supreme Court, as well as every other type of story imaginable, it sort of all came together in this particular book. And I wanted to be very careful that the emphasis here was on the legal process and the trials without writing in a dry legal kind of way, because I have always found trials to be fascinating. They're microcosms of, you know, the human condition. And that's what I wanted to do with this book.
And what was your biggest challenge? Because it could be a craft challenge, it could always be a research challenge, or it could be a family member challenge. What
Or
really was
all of the
hardest?
above. The research challenge was that because the federal trial resulted in an acquittal, there was no appeal, and the federal government cleans out its National Archives attic periodically. There was no transcript of the federal trial. So I had to put that together through contemporary newspaper accounts. But again, newspapers were king back in the 40s, okay? Every major paper, Chicago Tribune, LA Times, New York Times, they all covered it daily. And they would often do Q&As of the transcript right in the paper. So that was useful. But I also was able to get, because there was an appeal in the paternity case, I was able to get from the California State Archives the entire transcript of the paternity trials, which was useful. Nobody's left alive anymore. So the sons and granddaughters of all the major players, I was able to find them through Ancestry. Many of them had a lot of little tidbits in their attics that were useful. The chaplains would not cooperate with me at all for this book. I don't know why, because this is not a new story. It has shown up before in other biographies, but they wanted nothing to do with this. But I did find the alleged chaplain baby, the child that Joan Barry gave birth to in 1943. Her name is Carol Ann. She cooperated with the promise I would not reveal her last name or where she lived, but she was a gold mine because I know everything about her mother's life through her. I have beautiful pictures in the book that she generously gave me. And she wanted her mother's story told because her mother's always been painted as a nut. And yes, her mother had mental health issues, but her mother was also a victim here too.
Absolutely. Let's close then on one last question that dovetails exactly with that, which is, these, as you say, are not new stories. The casting couch and everything that goes with it has been around since the theater. And it is certainly the case that we are still seeing this today. And you have dealt with so many of these issues in your own courtrooms. What was different about what you came away with from doing this kind of deep dive than what you might have learned in the past?
I think what surprised me in writing this book is that when I started out by thinking this is a Me Too story. It is in part. And I'm loath to say this because I don't want to make it seem as if I am denigrating or blaming women at all. I am not. But in this particular case, both parties were flawed, and they were both victim and victimized, if that makes any sense. And I would like to think, perhaps my background as a judge has helped me here, that I have been as fair as possible in telling both of their stories. I don't know whether I have, but I hope so.
Well, as a reader, I can say I really felt that way. I felt pain for both of the all of the characters. I also felt chagrin, like stop making bad decisions. But I felt like as a book, you really captured the full sense of things in a way that was deeply fair and deeply sympathetic. And it makes me think, as someone who has only toiled in the barren fields of biography, that gee, it would have been a good idea to get some real education out in the world. And being a judge might be one of the best ways you can prepare to be a biographer, but I'd wait till you retire like you did, Diane. This was a wonderful conversation. Thank you to Biographers International, which is where we met. And thanks to you, Diane, for this wonderful book. I highly recommend it and hope to see you soon.
Thank you.
That was author Diane Kiesel speaking with fellow biographer Debbie Applegate about her latest book, When Charlie Met Joan, The Tragedy of the Chaplain Trials and the Failings of American Law. It's set to be published by the University of Michigan Press in February of this year. This interview was recorded via Zoom in December 2024. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Darren Neblett created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.